Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-Day CRE Challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you guys are doing fantastic. Today we have Steven Kashanian, and today we're going to hear all about how he started his business and what is he doing in commercial real estate. We're going to discuss the market. We're going to get and dive deep into the multifamily asset class, and we're going to discuss that. It's going to be very interesting. Steven, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate your time.
Good morning, Ishai. Thank you for having me.
No problem. You know what? Before we start, if you could give us like the elevator pitch of what you guys do, and then we're going to dive deep a little bit into the story of how you started.
We are a family-owned, vertically integrated acquisition management and development company. And we focus on the acquisition of value-added properties in New York and the boroughs. We focus on retail, mixed use, and multifamily properties.
Sounds exciting, and we have a bunch of things to discuss. That's how it sounds. Tell me something. How did you get into real estate? How did it all start for you?
Out of college, I needed to figure out what I wanted to do as a grown-up. I didn't have a lot of money, but I knew people that did. And at the time, everyone seemed to be flocking into real estate. So I took my salesman license and I started sourcing acquisitions for a few of my close friends and families. Till I found a very good opportunity in the city. I went to my top client at the time. I'm like, if you want the property, I'm coming in as the partner. And that, thank God, was a turning point in my career. We bought a retail condo with a 302 Broome Street in Lower Manhattan. And we achieved higher rents than projected. And that really was a turning point because it allowed me to finally make a transition from brokerage to equity.
Tell me something. What would you point out was the thing that got you, meaning from being a broker to become a guy who does acquisitions and become to the ownership part, what knowledge base you felt you needed in order to go and cross that line?
It's not a lot about the knowledge. It's more a matter of attitude. Knowledge, you know, at the end of the day, the numbers are relatively simple. The analysis, the diligence, it's something that most people can do easily. It's really a matter of mindset and attitude, because once you're on the other side of the table and you're the one that has to make a decision and a commitment of moving forward and giving a non-refundable deposit and sourcing the debt and sourcing the equity, closing on the deal, and running an asset, it's just a different ballgame.
Totally different ballgame. Definitely. 100%. Let's talk a little bit about the types of deals you guys do. The types of multifamily, the types of deals. What are you guys going after?
So we focus on the smaller market, and we play a lot in the 1 to 10 million market, but we do an exorbitant amount of volume. We typically buy properties that have a lot of hair. It can be structural problems, can be tenancy problems, can be vacancy, and things of that nature.
So any single thing that has some value add, aspect to it, what would, if you could give us some, to excite us a little bit about the, a few examples of repositioning that you guys had to do, which was tremendous for you, for your investors and everybody else.
In the Bronx, it's a very well located building. One of our lines of business is actually student housing. So when we bought the building, oh, wow, and we paid $5.5 million for only 21,000 square feet. So we paid a big number at the time, but we have a vision for that neighborhood, for that area, and we executed flawlessly brought up rents significantly. These were free market apartments to begin with. So we were able to reposition them and cater to the needs of the local market.
Tell me something. You know, if we were already touching student housing, something that I also personally know, to educate everybody else who is not in student housing, how would you say, you know, student housing would be different in terms of the way we look at it from acquisitions and management, asset management perspective, different than the classic multifamily? How would you define that?
So there are different tiers of student housing. As far as the numbers goes, I don't think there is much of a difference. A lot of the difference lies mainly on management and asset management, because you're dealing with a different type of tenants, with a different type of needs and expectations. And you want to make sure that you're meeting those needs and expectations so that you can keep growing organically.
Can you give us like an example or two of what types of, students, what type of expectations they may have versus obviously, you know, the classic family that would move there?
So what we do, we really try to create, we invested a lot of time and effort and money in creating a sense of community within that specific portion of the portfolio.
That's cool.
So we have a lot of activities that our tenants can participate in. That requires a lot of planning, marketing, and so on.
I got it.
So for example, on Mondays, we'll do Coffee Mondays. This means that in one of our lounges, we'll have free coffee and donuts for our students. They can come grab breakfast before they go to school. This is a small example, but just to give you an idea of the type of activities. And, you know, just to do a simple coffee and donut still requires some planning and organizing, have someone go pick it up, set up the table, make sure that everything goes well, clean up after them. And like this, we do tens and tens and many other programs. So it's a lot more hands-on on the management side.
You know, going to that discussion, just wanted to hear what you think about it. Prior to COVID, you had those assets, those type of properties, those type of deals, I would call them, that you had like a co-living environment, right? COVID then sort of made all shift in the world. But what are your thoughts, having the experience with student housing, about that, about how students take that as perspective and how it changed throughout COVID?
That's a very good question. So we did have some co-living companies as our tenants in Brooklyn. And when COVID hit, they were the first ones to hand back the keys. An interesting phenomenon, though, is that in our student housing portfolio, we didn't see that. We actually even noticed a small uptick in rents, which is very counterintuitive. I think that student housing is a little bit more isolated as an asset class than co-living and other categories. And that's an area that we are very, very focused on.
It's interesting. Do you think that post-COVID, this whole co-living concept will come back, or you think it's dead? What are your thoughts about it? Are you guys looking at that?
I think that like anything else, it's going to adapt. It's going to change. I don't think it's a dead concept. Instead of having 12 people in an 8-bedroom, you may have 4 people that need a little bit more space. So as a concept, I don't think it's dead. I just don't think they're going to be able to squeeze as many bodies into that type of square footage as they did before.
All right. Beautiful. Tell me something. What are the locations, when you look today at deals, what are the locations that you look at today that you think are stronger than other locations? Meaning, where would you put your emphasis?
It's a complicated question.
Yes, it is.
I'll tell you that we are heavily engaged and focused in Manhattan. because we are seeing a level of opportunity that we're not seeing in the other boroughs. We're very contrarian by nature. So Baruch Hashem, since March of last year, we've done over 30 acquisitions, separate acquisitions. And the reason why I'm breaking that up is because a lot of them were actually in areas and markets and neighborhoods and blocks that we were not able to touch 3, 5, 8, 10 years ago. And what we're seeing now, there seems to be a lot more competition in the boroughs, but it seems like Manhattan is lagging. So we're finding an incredible amount of opportunity and value in the city. About a month ago, we closed on the corner of 42nd and 9th Avenue. Five building portfolio. Never in my career did I expect to be able to touch a piece on 42nd Street. We're buying a building on Billionaires Row. We're buying a building on Broadway in the hundreds. So because of what happened in the market, we're able to position ourselves to buy better bricks, better located at a lower basis. And I think this is going to be a common theme, at least for the next 6 to 12 months.
Tell me something. Now that we started talking about Manhattan, it's a topic that I find extremely interesting because, as you've mentioned, I had some, you know, a few conversations with other people about that. And you know, Manhattan, New York City became a totally different conversation than the other boroughs because of whatever happened there. Can you elaborate a little bit and educate us a little bit from your perspective of how Manhattan is different than the other boroughs in terms of what happened? And in terms of the valuations, and in terms of the opportunity that you could find today versus what happened before. That is very interesting to hear.
So I spend a lot of my time on the streets, talking to people and noticing trends. So if you walk in Brooklyn, it seems like COVID never happened. If you go to certain pockets of Queens, the same thing. The Bronx, the same.
Manhattan. What do you mean COVID didn't happen? Like, what do you see? Like,
the foot traffic, the volume in the stores, the car traffic. You know, there is a lot of life and activity through the boroughs.
Right.
Manhattan, it's not the same because it's heavily reliant on office. And it's kind of scary because you walk around in Midtown or downtown and you'll see this entire tower is vacant or semi-vacant.
It's deserted.
It's deserted. So my assumption is that until people go back to work in the city and start filling up these office buildings, there's going to be more of a lag in Manhattan as opposed to the other boroughs. But that being said, we've noticed a dramatic uptick in retail leasing in Manhattan. Things are getting significantly better. People realize that this was not the end of the world. Most of the people that fled New York in the middle of the pandemic are coming back or came back already. Schools are opening up, universities are opening up, a lot of the restaurants are back in business. So we're definitely on the right trajectory, but the only reason why I think the Manhattan is still lagging behind is because of the office component that the other boroughs are not relying on as much.
That's very interesting. And also the fact there's a huge separation, and that's also my opinion, between the office and residential in Manhattan, because, you know, everybody else found a way to work either from home or, you know, people can work from New Jersey. They can rent an office in New Jersey and, you know, it's not so bad. And all of a sudden, that's how you find a whole building in Manhattan that is vacant or half a building that is vacant. And right, it affects the residential part. But at the same time, what we hear in terms of the residential is that things are coming back. Let me ask you this. If an investor comes in and wants to ask you, Stephen, I'm thinking of putting my money into a deal in Manhattan. Why can that deal to multifamily? I'm not talking about office. I think that you would agree that office is still in the unknown. But in terms of the multifamily, why is it still an opportunity now while we see what happened? Maybe there's forbearance. Maybe the real valuation didn't come up. Maybe it's only fairy dust, as we call it. Maybe it's not real. How can I know that it's a real opportunity and not just fake?
we make our money on the buy. In other words, we need to make sure that the basis is low enough so that if you do have a surprise, you're able to carry it through, right? So I am very bearish on stabilization. There is a lot of other talks about other things coming through the pipeline. So there is really nothing you can do there. But if you're buying a rent stabilized building at a 6 cap, 6.5 cap, you're borrowing in the low 3s or high 2s, you're positive day one. So you don't need to create as much value and you can ride it out. There is opportunity on the free market stuff. Rents are coming back. So it really depends on the appetite and on the tolerance to paint that the investor has. But I do believe that there is still good opportunities in the multifamily, just a different game, but that doesn't mean that you cannot source opportunities.
Tell me something. In terms of, you know, a lot of people are talking about, like, the talk about New York before COVID was rent regulations, right? Everything that happened to rent regulations, talking about free market versus, you know, apartment that has under the rent regulations issues. So here's what I want to ask you. When you're looking at deals, how do you look at those that have the rent regulated issues and how do you stay away from them? Or if you do want them, what are your views about that?
You can still buy rent stabilized buildings and not lose money. It all depends on the basis that you're buying it at and what your expectations are. So as long as you're cognizant of the laws, what you can, what you cannot do, and you're playing within those rules, that today is very cheap. So if you're able to buy a rent-stabilized building at a fair yield going in, and you have a long-term horizon, I don't think that's a bad place to be in. But if you're buying a 2, 3, 4 cap and it's fully rent stabilized, then there is nothing you can do. Again, it all boils down to pricing and basis.
I got it. So you're saying it all depends on how much you buy for, and it all depends on where you're going into. And obviously, if it's a fully rent stabilized building, that is going to be an issue no matter how you look at it. That's what you're saying, I'm assuming.
It's not necessarily an issue. It's just a reality. So as long as you're cognizant about it day one and your expectations are aligned, then you'll be fine.
It is what it is, as we say. We can't do anything more. Yeah. But if the basis when you acquire the building is low enough, makes it a good deal, then it will stay a good deal and that's it. You can stay with it. There's no value add play. You started talking about debt. Debt is very cheap, you said.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Financing today, the environment, the banks, what are their requirements?
The market is very fluid. There is amazing debt available. And there is a little bit more underwriting and diligence on part of the lender. But as long as you're a strong sponsor and your paperwork is in order, it's not an issue. We're doing a lot of loans with traditional banks. And the rates on stabilized assets is in the low 3s. The bridge type of product, it's in the high 4s, low 5s. And that's assuming you're not over-levering, right? So there is an incredible opportunity to secure debt at very affordable rates, which is, in my opinion, one of the main reasons why the market has rebounded the way it has.
You know what? A lot of people are talking about what will happen to the market when the whole interest rate will change, inflation, blah, 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 all those talks, right? What is your take on it in terms of what can happen to debt and if it could change and how will it change the market and the deals?
The way I look at things is in phases, right? Short term, midterm, and long term.
Right.
In the short term, our focus is finding unique opportunities and executing. And my assumption is that as long as your execution is pristine and you come through in the next 12 to 18 months, then you're going to be fine. What's going to happen in the future, I don't know. It's obvious that if rates do go up, there is going to be an effect on valuations. But thank God we've been in business since 2007. And we were able to do deals in 2015, 16, 17, 18, which were very, very competitive years. And we continue doing deals through the downturn. So every market, every cycle has its own challenges, but also opportunities.
You just said something really cool. You just said that you started 2007, right? Am I correct?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that. That was the heavy time. You got in, yeah. And in what way, and how was the market then? How did you manage to actually pull it through?
I think 2007, I started closed as a brokerage.
Okay.
I came out of college. I was studying for my master's at night. So during the day, I had to work, make money. And I was a broker till 2013. So for a good 6 years.
Oh, you went through the whole cycle then?
Yeah, sourcing opportunities for some close friends and family. Till I had that break with a retail account in downtown. But the main point is that, yes, it's good to be prepared for long term, but you don't really know what's going to happen. So the best you can do is to make decisions on a day by day with the data you have. And really execution, it's the main differentiator. As long as you're buying at an attractive basis and you're very strong in your execution, you should be able to continue.
Tell me something. When you got, you know, from that point, going back to that point that you changed your career from being a broker to becoming an owner, tell us a little bit of this experience of being a guy who is hands off, you know, getting into the deal, getting off the deal, all of a sudden you're hands on, you have to actually sign a loan. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
It's terrifying. It's really, 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 really scary. And it still happens to me very often. The day before we are either signing a contract or going out on a contract, it's scary because all of a sudden everything that could go wrong all of a sudden pops in your head. And I think that it's a very healthy reaction. I actually embrace it because it's very important to be proactive. And whenever we have an opportunity that we're acquiring, we make a proper business plan. We try to understand what are the threats, what could go wrong. We try to have a contingency plan, and then we execute. So it's very, very important that whenever you are the one making the decision, you understand the nuances of the deal, and you align your interest with one of your partners and lenders, which could be tricky at times. But as you said, it's more of a mental exercise because you know you realize that if things do go south, it's your name on that loan, it's your reputation with that partner and lender, and you know it could be very damaging.
That's right. Thank you for sharing that. Let me tell me something. When you got to a point where you start your own, obviously, you know, your own shop, as we call it. There's a point where your business becomes, when it grows, right? You have to hire a team. You have to hire more people. Can you tell us a little bit about also that part? Meaning where you are like a one-man show, maybe you have another right-hand man. All of a sudden, you have to become a business. How is that in terms of what you know, that transition? Tell us about that transition. What do you feel about it? How do you go about how you went about it? And how you went to, you know, the next level?
I tell you, that's probably one of my main struggles because nobody really teaches you on how to build a team. And ultimately, you are as strong as your team. And you want to make sure that as you're growing, you have the right people around you who have their interests aligned with you so that can help you execute on your vision. The way we do it, it's slow and steady. So we didn't go from 4 people to 43 overnight. It's been a very gradual process. We tend to be overstaffed on the asset management side, just because the type of assets that we buy require a lot of effort. When you're buying a 20 family with 700 violations, there is a lot of effort that needs to go into that. So we're constantly rethinking the way we're doing things. We're constantly looking for good people to join our team. And the thing that I realized the hard way is that ultimately, especially when it comes to management, you get what you pay for. So we used to look for people that were cheaper on the salary side, but they didn't necessarily have a lot of experience. But I soon realized that I was the idiot paying for their education. And that's a very expensive, that's a very expensive education. So it's very challenging, but ultimately, I'm very proud of the fact that we were able to build a very strong team of true professionals that they really care about the well-being of the company, because they ultimately realize that their own upside is tied into what we're doing.
Tell me something. With the team that you have today, how would you divide? You said you're very strong on the asset management part. Can you tell us a little bit about how a real estate organization like yours is really, you know, set up in terms of the personnel, what they do, what, you know, you focus on, et cetera, not only the asset management?
So we are a little bit different in a sense that we run separate lines of business that are interconnected, right? So we have closed properties, which is our acquisition arm. And we have Blue Sky Group, which is the asset management arm. But under Blue Sky Group, we have the development. We're a licensed GC, so we do our own construction. But we also do third-party construction. We do leasing, management, and so on. So there are separate lines of business that are interconnected. On the management side, we divided the portfolio based on geographic territory. So each portfolio would have his own porters, his own supers, and his borough manager. Then on top of that, we have a director of operations. Separate to that, we have a head of asset management, we have a director of management, and he has his own structure. So it's fairly structured. And I think that it's very important to have a tight structure, because it allows you to define job responsibilities, job descriptions, and make sure that everyone is on the same page.
It sounds very organized and very good. Tell me something about relationships, you know, investor relations wise. Tell us a little bit about how you built the relationships. How was the beginning versus today? And, you know, to build that track record is not a simple thing, of course.
No, it's not a simple thing. It takes a lot to gain the trust of people, especially when you're dealing with their savings. And it's even harder to execute on a consistent basis when you're doing a lot of volume over time. One thing I've noticed is that you could make 14, 15 deals with one person and they all go flawlessly. The 16th one, it's a good outcome, but not as good. And then you're going to be judged based on the 16th one. I've spoken about this with several of my peers, and they all share the same experience. I guess it's human nature. But ultimately, I think that especially in our line of business, we have to be judged by our execution. That's the only thing that matters at the end of the day. Because investors, when they come to you and they trust you with their money, they're expecting a certain level of execution. And they don't really care if the market is up or down and rates went up and the rentals came in and the tenant left. That's not their problem. that is your problem as the operator to make sure that you execute. And if you do, over time, it does get easier raising capital.
That's a beautiful aspect. What tip you give someone who's dealing with investors? And obviously, there's a point beyond the execution and the results that you give people, right? Yeah, the relationship that you have with people, the investors. What tip could you give to a person who's dealing with investors and is getting into a deal today or tomorrow?
I think the only thing that really matters is transparency. Because ultimately, if you're transparent and the investor is aware of everything that could go wrong or does go wrong, and you're very forthright about it, and then does mitigate a lot of the other issues. And that's something that we focus on a lot. Whenever we are sourcing a new acquisition, the main topic of conversation is not how amazing the location is, but is what are the real threats? What are the real problems? What can we do to mitigate those? And as long as the partner is aware of that and it's on his radar and he understands and he shares your vision and game plan, then I've noticed that a lot of the noise disappears because problems do arise. Things that are completely unexpected do happen. So you want to make sure that your partners are aware of those situations so that when they do happen, at least you're not going to look like an idiot.
Good tip. Steven, before we said our goodbyes, tell people where they can find you. Obviously, guys, look at the links below and above. But beyond that, Steven, you want to tell people when they want to find you, whether it's from the brokers and investors and...
We're very active on social media. Our website is closedproperties.com. We are on LinkedIn.
Close, on again, what's the name of the website? So we'll say it for people listening to the audio.
Closedproperties.com with
Closedproperties.com with a K.
With a K, yes.
Closedproperties.com with a K. Okay, go ahead.
We're also very active on LinkedIn and Instagram. My personal email is sk@closedllc.com, again with a K.
All right. No problem. So you guys heard everything from Steven. I hope you guys learned a lot today or heard a lot today and got a good perspective on the market. I really liked the part, the discussion about Manhattan. That's really enlightening and actually a very positive aspect and very, optimistic one. So I thank you for that. Really appreciate that. And I hope you guys enjoyed it. And I'm going to see you guys on the next show. Take care of yourselves. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.